monitor here up there. Get everybody seated.
This meeting of the Joint Health, Housing, Family Security, and Environment and Natural Resource Committee's joint hearing will come to order. Appreciate people coming here. One business note for the people on the inside of the table, the mics are very directional, so when you ask questions or have comments, please hold the mics or move them close to you. The plans for today are we're going to have first a very brief presentation, an update on an interagency look at atrazine. And then after that, we have two bills on the agenda. We're going to take all the testimony. We're going to have the discussion, all that process. And then after we've done that with both bills, then we will adjourn the joint committee meeting. Our committee, the Senate Health Committee, will continue meeting, vote on the bills, and then but they have to be referred to your committee after going through the Senate. So we will adjourn the joint committee after all the discussion and questions and so on. And Senator Shaw, do you have any comments? If not, I'd like to begin with the three departments making brief presentation on atrazine. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stein and Mr. Brzezicki and Mr. Hora.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Greg Brzezicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I should just provide a short overview, and then if there's questions of myself or others, we'd be happy to answer them, if that would be fine, Mr. Chair. As a way of a brief, very brief background for the committee members, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture registers pesticides. Pesticides are registered by EPA, and we in turn at the Department of Agriculture register them for use in this state. We register about 13,000 products. That's about 1,000 active ingredients. Before you, you will see a fact sheet, and I'm going to briefly walk through this, and then we'll stand for questions. Up until 2006, the department had, like about 46 other states, taken EPA's scientific review and applied it to Minnesota and accepted that, and seldom used our registration authority to do additional review. In 2006, legislative auditor made a recommendation that we should do more, somewhat like a few of the other states were doing, is to take a look at specific and certain pesticides on a regular basis for particular problems that may or may not be encountered for their use in Minnesota. We have begun that process, and Mr. Chair, what we're here to do is bring you up to speed a little bit as to how that process is proceeding. We have chosen as our first pesticide to look at atrazine, and because we have not done this before, we issued in September a scoping document. This is basically a document that starts to describe what we are going to be looking for in a special registration review process. Because the Department of Agriculture registers pesticides but does not have the expertise necessarily or the authority to deal with issues such as drinking water, direct human exposure, risk assessment, in other words, and environmental issues, we have enlisted and cooperated with our sister agencies, the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. They were instrumental, and we have been meeting for some time to develop that scoping document. That scoping document was posted, listed in the State Register in September. We opened it up for comments. We received only a few comments, although I will say one of the comments from the registrant, one of the principal registrants, was quite extensive, providing more information, which we appreciate. And since that time, we closed the comment in November, and since that time we meet on a monthly basis, and we are working towards the actual review process. After reviewing the comments, we will then be issuing a technical document and and distributing that, we hope, in September. But this is an extensive amount of work, and as I said, we haven't been through it before. So in September or so, we will be distributing that technical document for comments, and then hopefully by the end of the year, we will be providing recommendations to the commissioner, and the commissioner will be then publicizing for comment his intention on how to deal with the active ingredient atrazine for registration purposes in the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, committee members, in going through this, it should be noted that atrazine is has been controversial, certainly in the state, but it's also been very extensively reviewed at the national level. There are a number of studies ongoing, and we are looking at this process not to duplicate what is taking place at the national level, but rather to look at specific issues that may or may not be, that may be of importance to its use in Minnesota. So at the end of the bottom line is that we may have some recommendations, we may have some additional regulations, or we may find that the standards, the regulations, and so forth are perfectly fine. But we are striving for this to be a very transparent and public process and science-based. Mr. Chair and committee members, we may have taken on perhaps one of the most extensively studied pesticide products in the country, but we thought that that was appropriate given the nature of the controversies and the issues in Minnesota. After we complete the review of atrazine, then we're looking at using this process on an ongoing basis for several products each year. But as I had indicated, it is new to us, and it's a lot of work, and we're still finding our way through. So, Mr. Chair, that's my brief summary. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them. My counterparts from the other agencies would be happy to answer questions as well.
Are there questions from the committees? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just the question would be is why we originally, was it the department's initiative or was it a legislative initiative that actually got the impetus to do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, and I'll let Mr. Buzicki speak about this as well, but as he mentioned, there was a legislative auditor's report on pesticide regulation a couple of years ago, and a number of legislators were interested in pursuing it further. So. Did you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, no. Prior to that, we had not done extensive use of our registration authority, or we had not extensively used our registration authority in screening products. We'd relied on EPA. The auditor brought forward that under certain circumstances, we may want to look at particular limited numbers of active ingredients for Minnesota-specific conditions. So that's what we're attempting to do.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Brzezinski, is the EPA's testing, does that have loop or holes in it in terms of like geographic areas where they test, or are there, when you look at the research that's being done, can we clearly pick out areas that we could kind of zero in on in terms of Minnesota's vast water supply or type of soil or something like that that would be non-duplicative but rich in information for Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, EPA does extensive testing and review in their registration process, and they also do a registration re-review looking at environmental and health issues. As you are probably aware, the federal law is a risk-benefit, so we have to look at the benefits of any particular pesticide as well as the risks. What we are looking at, because EPA's effort is a national effort, is exactly that question. Are there particular aspects of the use either the risks or the benefits of atrazine in Minnesota that we should pay attention to, and if there are additional risks, are there ways that we can address those through additional restrictions or label restrictions, something like that. That's what we're actually examining.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Buzicki, I want to say I think it's very nice the agencies are working together on this from the different perspectives. I wondered, you mentioned that you had four comments from four interested parties. Were they vast variety of different sectors as well? Or?
Mr. Chair, we had extensive technical comments and data that was submitted by the registrant, which we found to be very helpful. We also had a couple of environmental agencies provide some general comments and a few additional technical resources or recommendations for us to look at technical resources, and a private citizen make the comments. So they were not extensive.
Okay.
But we will be keeping this process open once we get the technical review done so people can see our results and be able to comment on that. So we anticipate there will be more comments. And, Mr. Chair, I just want to say the agencies work together very well on many, many issues. This is a good example of how we can benefit from the use of their expertise, and, in fact, we rely on it. So we are very appreciative of their efforts.
Well, I appreciate that. One final question. Wisconsin has done some restrictions on atrazine use. Is that based on soil type where they're restricting it, and was that an agency-initiated effort or –
Mr. Chair, Wisconsin does have some restrictions in place. It's based on monitoring, and it's based on soil type. As part of this review, we'll be reexamining that and looking at that as to its potential applicability to the state of Minnesota. We've worked very closely with Wisconsin over the years, so we're quite familiar with their process. That was actually an agency rule. I would have to say it was about 8 or 10 years ago that they initiated that.
Thank you. Any further questions from members of the committees? If not, very much appreciate your updates.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rummel, we have Senate File 247. Welcome to the committees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, and committee members. First of all, I would like to thank you for holding this joint hearing on this bill, because it has certainly made it easier for the people that we will bring to the table. So I appreciate your accommodating us. I'm here on behalf of constituents in my community whose concerns about the chemicals in children's toys are high. Over the last couple of years, awareness about chemicals and products that children use has gone up exponentially. So I'm here representing them and bringing forward a bill aimed at protecting little children. This bill is very similar to the bill I carried last year. It's a very narrow bill. It looks at phasing out BPA, bisphenol A, from products intended for children under the age of 3. So it's a very limited bill. The types of products we're talking about are baby bottles, sippy cups, toys, and infant formula containers. The big change that I made from last year's bill is to include a 2-stage phase out. We are trying to be sensitive to industry and to be practical in our approach. I believe this bill will have a great impact on the current and future health of our children, but it has no fiscal note to it. This is a safe and cost, there are safe and cost-effective alternatives available on the market today. Before we go forward, I'd like to just briefly run through the bill. Senate File 247 prohibits the sale of children's products, including containers of infant formula that contain bisphenol A. Section 1 defines terms. Section 2 prohibits manufacturers from selling new children's products that contain bisphenol A effective January 2010. and infant formula containers that contain bisphenol A, effective January 2013. Section 3 prohibits manufacturers from replacing bisphenol A with a chemical that is classified as a known human carcinogen or reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen, or identified by the EPA as causing birth defects, hormone disruption, reproductive, or environmental harm. And finally, Section 4 authorizes the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to participate in the establishment and implementation of multi-state clearinghouse to identify children's products containing bisphenol A and to evaluate safer alternatives. So that's what this bill is about. I have a couple of witnesses. I first would like to introduce Julia Earle. She's a parent, and she can speak to her perspective on the importance of this bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Earle. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committees. My name is Julia Earle, and I'm a parent. I appreciate the opportunity to share testimony with all of you today. As indicated, I'm here in my capacity as a parent speaking in support of Senate File 247. I have two children who are 9 and 6 years old. When I was pregnant with my children, I did all the things I could to ensure healthy outcomes for them. I stopped drinking coffee and alcohol, I took prenatal vitamins, and I even stayed away from toxic fumes, insisting that my husband and father-in-law stain and varnish a dresser we had painstakingly assembled for our new baby. In spite of taking all these action steps during pregnancy, I was completely baffled when it came to identifying and purchasing safe baby products for my infant son and daughter. I'm well educated. I have a Master's of Science degree, and my husband is a college professor. Nonetheless, between the two of us, we didn't know if baby products were safe for our kids. This included everything from breast milk storage containers to baby bottles to pacifiers, teethers, first spoons, sippy cups, and even toys. Finding safe products for babies and children shouldn't be added to the already daunting and exhausting work of parenting and keeping our children safe. Parents do everything we can to keep our kids safe. The myriad tasks include covering electrical outlets, preventing pot handles from sticking out over the edge of the stove, turning down our hot water heaters to prevent scalding, using car seats, and, of course, helping our toddlers cross the street. Being able to figure out which baby toys and products might cause harm should not be on this list. Please do what's right by supporting Senate File 247, the BPA-free baby products bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Earle. Are there questions from any members of the committee? Not. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I believe Lindsay Dahl will. Lindsay Dahl, who is here from the Healthy Legacy.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thanks for having me. My name is Lindsay Dahl, and I work with Healthy Legacy. My comments will be pretty brief today. I work for Healthy Legacy, and we are a statewide public health coalition that has 30 different member organizations that span across the state. Our tagline is that we're dedicated to safe products made safely, and we really focus on eliminating the unnecessary exposure of toxic chemicals in children's products. So to give you an idea of kind of who our coalition represents, we're really diverse, which is kind of exciting. We bring together groups that have never sat at the table before. So we have groups like ARC and the Learning Disabilities Association. We have the League of Women Voters, the Parent Teacher Association, all these different groups from different backgrounds coming together to make sure that we're protecting children's health in any way that we possibly can. So Healthy Legacy strongly supports both the bills that are being heard today. And, you know, we travel around the state and we go into local retailers. Retailers and markets are moving on this issue. Baby bottle manufacturers are voluntarily phasing this chemical out. There's so much momentum. Canada has recently agreed to phase it out. You know, for example, Walmart isn't carrying any baby bottles that have BPA. So it's really, it's on its way out. But the problem is that we talk to parents all over the state that mention exactly what Julia Earle just said, is that they have to do a research project before they go to the store. And our coalition is really saying, you know what, parents shouldn't have to do a research project to find safe baby bottles. So that's really why we support this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Dr. Myers. Dr. John Peterson Myers is the CEO and co-founder and chief scientist for the Environmental Health Sciences. He has a doctorate from University of California, Berkeley in biological sciences. Dr. Myers is also the co-author of Our Stolen Future, published in 1996. He co-authored with Dr. Theo Colburn and Diane Dumanowski. The book explores the scientific basis for contamination that threatens fetal development. Now Dr. Myers is involved in primary research on the impacts of endocrine disruption on human health. He has testified before Congress. He is a well-respected scientist. Dr. Myers.
Thank you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, Chairman Chowdhury. It's an honor to be here addressing the Joint Committee. I am also glad to be sharing a little bit of Minnesota winter with you. I come from Virginia, where it was 57 yesterday. I'm going to explore some of the implications of new findings about bisphenol A and the implications of that for human health. I want to begin, however, by laying before you a picture of a revolution in the environmental health sciences that creates the context for understanding what these new findings on bisphenol A mean. And I'd like to offer a metaphor to get you thinking about this revolution in the right way. The way that toxicology has been done over the last several hundred years has missed some key mechanisms that we're now learning about through modern environmental health science. And I want you to think about, what if you were the Coast Guard? And your responsibility in protecting shipping in the Atlantic used methods of old toxicology in a metaphoric way. You would make sure that no one was capable of bombing one of those ships as it went across the Atlantic. You would have large numbers of Coast Guard boats ensuring the safety of those vessels. Old toxicology looked to very conspicuous effects. New toxicology is concerned about whether or not the compass in that boat is headed in the right direction. 1 or 2 degrees off course, a difference that won't be visible when the boat leaves the harbor, when the baby is born, 1 or 2 degrees off course can lead to profound health consequences as that baby matures and becomes an adult. And what we're learning through this new science is it varies. Subtle changes, subtle at birth, subtle changes in the womb, can cause profound differences in the developmental course that the baby takes, and that these changes in development can actually have effects throughout the life of the individual, including contributing to conditions like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and obesity. This is a profoundly new way, small changes in birth, changing the course of development, creating health risks that are actually among some of the most costly health risks that we face today in America. So that's the metaphor for this new science. We are midstream in a scientific revolution as a result of huge investments by governments around the world in attempting to understand how the effect of contaminants early in life can alter the course of development. It's causing profound changes in what we're learning about the links, the scientific links between human health, including the chronic diseases of adulthood. There are some unexpected discoveries that are emerging from this science, have to do with bisphenol A, have to do with phthalates, have to do with other compounds, compounds that we let into our homes, that we put into products that children use, things that old toxicology taught us were safe. But I want you to focus on one aspect of this message, which I believe is the most important one, which is this new science is telling us there are opportunities to prevent disease by acting on this new science that we didn't perceive within the framework of the old toxicology. Important opportunities that actually may be very consequential with respect to finding meaningful ways to reduce the cost of healthcare. That's how important this new science is. What does it mean? Well, traditional toxicology and epidemiology, as they have been practiced, are highly likely to have underestimated the risks of low-dose exposures on human health. These sciences can do a much better job as they learn to incorporate this new science, and when they do, I'm confident people will be healthier. We live in an era when, if you talk to public health officials, this generation of children is the first generation for a long, long time not to be as healthy as their parents. That's not a happy signal. This new science is telling us how we can fix that for the future. There are four key discoveries in this new science. The first is that some contaminants can alter gene behavior at extremely low doses. The second key finding is that the tools that we have used to ask, is this dangerous, is this safe, they've depended upon doing high-dose experiments and then extrapolating those to the possible consequences of low-dose chronic exposure to people. Unfortunately, we're learning that for certain types of contaminants, those high-dose experiments don't give us a clue about what's happening at low doses. That's a really vital finding. Third, mixtures of chemicals are ubiquitous. They interact in some ways unpredictably, other ways predictably, but most certainly they interact, and none of the current health standards, for example, that relate to bisphenol A, have ever considered the interaction of bisphenol A with other compounds. And finally, as I mentioned before, adult chronic diseases can be programmed during development. If any of you are physicians, you'll have heard of the fetal basis of adult disease, a very important new field in medicine. And exposure to environmental contaminants are part of that picture. I'm going to show you this picture here of two mice because it captures three of these core findings. I won't have time today, given the limits on time, but to go into the mixtures issue. I'll be happy to answer questions about it. But if you look at those two mice, there's obviously a conspicuous difference between them. Now, this is work done by the National Institute of Health. It's the same strain of mice. The mice were monitored from birth for their activity levels and for their caloric intake, and there were no differences between them. But obviously, the mouse on your right, representative of the experimental group, is grotesquely obese, whereas the mouse on your left is normal. What's the difference? The mouse on the right, was exposed to 1 part per billion of a potent synthetic estrogen called diethylstilbestrol right around birth. The current hypothesis, for which there's considerable evidence, but scientific certainty is still not with us, the current hypothesis is that what that chemical has done is increase the rate at which stem cells are becoming fat cells. So the animal's growing up with more fat cells, making it more vulnerable to becoming obese in adulthood. DES is very similar to bisphenol A, structurally and functionally. Bisphenol A also, in some experiments, causes grotesque obesity in adulthood. But if I were to have exposed that animal, when the scientists exposed that animal to high doses of DES, they actually caused weight loss. The fat animal would have been thinner than the control animal. And obviously, this is a case where developmental exposure to DES right around birth, led to obesity in adulthood. So here are the three key points. Low doses, a part per billion, can really matter. Second, high-dose tests, at 1,000 parts per billion, you would have expected, at best, less obesity in the lower dose. Instead, you had the opposite. With 1,000 parts per billion, it lost weight. So at 1 part per billion, you would have expected, by traditional standards, to see less weight loss. Instead, you see grotesque obesity. High-dose experiments don't predict low-dose results. And finally, developmental origins of adult disease. Now, when you think about this, you step back and ask, where does this new science have its roots? It really has its roots in the genetic basis of many human diseases. And when most people who aren't steeped in this science hear me say that, they scratch their heads. I can see a bunch of you are scratching your heads right now. Wait a second, he was talking environment. Now he's talking genetic basis of human disease. Well, This is because of the revolution in molecular genetics that's unfolded over the last couple of decades. And basically, it forces us to think about genes in two different ways. One is the way that most people think about genes, which is what we get from our parents. But the other is that genes are actually nature's nanotechnology. They're being turned on and off trillions of times a second throughout our lives. And that's where this science focuses. It's on the factors that affect the turning on and off of genes. And that's where the environment comes in. What factors alter gene expression? Well, classic genetics does matter. It matters what you inherit from your parents. And genes talk to one another all the time, sending chemical signals, often hormones, back and forth among one another. But it turns out that diet, stress, experience, and environmental contaminants all can alter gene expression in some astounding ways. And I'm going to focus today only on the effect of environmental contaminants on gene expression. We now have a growing list of contaminants that alter gene expression. This is just the beginning. I'll focus on bisphenol A because that's of interest to this committee. But it is, in essence, it's the poster child of this whole new way to look at the environmental origins of human disease. And what this does, this new framing, what it does is it flips on its head that old dichotomy we used to learn about in biology in high school, where it was genes versus environment, nature versus nurture. You remember that? Well, it flips it on its head so that, yes, what you inherit is vital, but the factors affecting gene expression interact with the genes that you inherited ultimately to control your health. And if things aren't being turned on or off at the right time, you may have a serious health problem. This new way of looking at the genetic basis of human disease has some very interesting big implications for how we go about thinking about disease. We used to think that if a disease was linked to genes, it was under hereditary control. How many of you have read something about the Human Genome Project in the last 3 months where it said, oh, schizophrenia is linked to a gene, or obesity is linked to a gene? And almost all of us react to that by saying, oh my God, did I get the bad gene from my parents? Right? The way I react to that is I ask, what laboratory in the world is looking for environmental factors that affect that gene's expression? Because that gives me an opportunity to intervene. You can't do much about what you inherited, but if you can identify environmental factors that alter that gene's expression, you may have a handle on ways to prevent a disease. The old way of looking at things didn't give us a clue, could have been preventable. This science, old science used to tell us that only high levels matter. Well, we now have many cases where epidemiological studies link human disease to effects at background, what people used to think were background levels, levels that, frankly, toxicologists and chemists couldn't even measure 20 years ago. We have lots of laboratory studies not just showing association, but showing causation. Exposure at low levels, extremely low levels, can cause serious developmental problems. So here we get to bisphenol A. Why did we think this was safe? Looks like a fine, solid material. Certainly does some nice things. It holds water wonderfully. It makes polycarbonate glasses. It lines the interior of cans in ways that protect the food from the can. But the problem is that it's not nearly as stable as it looks. It actually degrades over time as it is heated or as it's used or exposed to an acid or base, so that the individual components of this polycarbonate plastic enter into the water or the food that it has come into contact with. Now, bisphenol A was invented in 1895. We knew it by 1936 that it was a synthetic sex hormone. 1936. It wasn't quite as powerful as DES at the time, so it was put on a shelf. Polymer chemists discovered 20 years later that it actually could be used to make this plastic. And as a result of the many beneficial uses that have been discovered for bisphenol A, it now pervades our homes. It is everywhere. And as a result of that, when we look at people, we look at levels in people, we find in people's serum, these are representative data from Germany, we find levels on the parts per billion range. Old toxicology said, so what? How could a part per billion possibly matter? We care about large concentrations. Well, I want to think with you for a moment about what a part per billion means. What is a part per billion? Well, one way to look at it, it's one pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high. Pretty small amount. Let's think about it somewhat differently, however. Think about a baby bottle and a drop of milk, a drop of water in that baby bottle, and that water has one part per billion of bisphenol A in it. How many molecules of bisphenol A do you think are in that one drop? 10? 100? 132 billion molecules of bisphenol A are in that one drop. And if you have a biologically potent material, that's 132 billion opportunities to cause mischief. Now, this science changed radically beginning in the late 1990s when someone who wasn't a toxicologist at all asked a question about bisphenol A that no one who was a toxicologist would have bothered to ask because the standards of the day didn't make it seem relevant. And what Fred von Saal did was he was interested in how do estrogens, like DES or our native estrogen, affect the development of the male prostate. And he had learned that some estrogens cause that male prostate to grow up bigger than it would have, which is an interesting medical issue for humans, adult prostatitis and other effects. And what von Saal discovered was that unlike many estrogens, particularly the human estrogen, the natural one, bisphenol A isn't bound up by what are called serum-binding proteins. So there's a lot more free in the serum to do damage, even though molecule by molecule, it's weaker than by a lot than estradiol is, than the natural human hormone. So here you had something that's weaker but isn't bound up. And so he did some calculations that said, I should see results in my model system at 2 parts per billion. Exposing a male in the womb via the mother. And what he found was exactly what he predicted. 2 parts per billion led to a 35% increase in the adult prostate size of exposed males and a lifelong hypersensitization to further hormonal stimulation. Not a good thing for adult prostates. This study was highly contested. I'm sure we'll hear more about it later. I will have a little bit more to say. It has been replicated and it has been extended. This is an example of some beautiful microcomputer reconstructions of how the prostate grows in mice, upper one being the control, lower one being the experimental one, exposed to 20 parts per billion bisphenol A, where you can already, early in life, see big differences in the growth patterns of the prostate glands. Work on prostate has come a long ways. We know that 10 parts per billion causes high-grade pin lesions, by altering gene expression in the womb, work with rats. We know that adult exposures to bisphenol A causes human prostate tumors to escape the current medical treatment for prostate cancer. We know that bisphenol A in rats causes breast cancer in adult rats. We know that in human breast cancer cells, 1 part per billion bisphenol A antagonizes 3 of the common pharmaceutical agents used to treat breast cancer in women today. Antagonizes, wipes that response out. How am I doing for time? Okay. One of the most remarkable discoveries, often what you find in this science, is that someone who's doing a completely different type of work, a non-toxicologist, is all of a sudden blindsided in their lab. It's had an interesting effect because it's brought world-class scientists from other fields into asking questions about bisphenol A. This is a story that came out of Case Western University. A woman who's a world expert in what causes Down syndrome. The fundamental cause in Down syndrome is getting the wrong number of chromosomes in the fertilized embryo by having eggs or sperm have the wrong number and then they're fertilized. In essence, you have 3 copies of chromosome 21. That's Down syndrome. Here's a lab that's studying this using a mouse model. Very interested in what happens right at the time of cell division when the egg is being formed. There you see a classic egg being formed during meiosis as the chromosomes are being pulled apart. That red is the chromosomes. You can imagine as the spindles pull the... Remember basic biology, how much fun that was? as the chromosomes are being pulled apart, you get the right numbers in the 2 progeny of the division process. Well, what happened in this lab, and this is Down syndrome, where you have the wrong number of chromosomes in chromosome 21. What happened in this lab was one day, Professor Hunt came back to her lab, looked at the data, and they had found that there was a 20-fold increase in the rate of this error in cell division called aneuploidy. She found a 20-fold increase. She found, instead of normal-looking cells like that, she found ones that looked like the chromosomes had been shot in via with a shotgun. You can imagine that as the spindle pulls that one apart, it's not gonna work. This error in cell division is the single largest known source of spontaneous miscarriage in people. Most cases of aneuploidy in people die. What she learned through a lot of hard work was that her lab tech had used a somewhat harsh bleach to wash out the polycarbonate bottles that the mother mouse was drinking from. She then recreated this experiment in the lab, was able to show that down to about 20 parts per billion, she could show an effect on the rate of aneuploidy in her. There's been some epidemiology following up on this, and I won't go into details. Very small study, currently under replication, but its results are consistent with the predictions from this study, which is that women with somewhat higher levels of bisphenol A have higher rates of spontaneous miscarriage. It's a small study. It has to be replicated. It's exactly what was predicted by the animal work, however. Now, it's after lunch. I can share the inside of a mouse with you, I hope. This is Minnesota. Lots of farming going on around here. I'd be reluctant to show this in Washington, D.C. This is the inside of a mouse. These data have been reported at scientific meetings. They're not yet published. This is from Vamsal's lab. This is a normal mouse. It's got normal kidneys. It's got a bladder that you can barely see. It's got normal testes, so it's a male. What happens is this animal had been exposed to about 20 parts per billion bisphenol A in the womb. That animal had been allowed to age for two or three more days. It's about my age in mouse years. If that animal had been allowed to age for about two or three more days, its bladder literally would have exploded. Its kidneys have gone necrotic. They don't work anymore. How did this happen? Remember the boat crossing the Atlantic? In this case, what they know is that there were subtle changes in what's called epigenetic programming, the factors controlling how genes are turned on and off, in a key place in the urethra of these animals. The urethra is the tube that connects the bladder to the outside world. That's what you pee through. So those epigenetic changes altered the course of development of the mouse urethra to the point that as it was aging and the ratio of estrogen to testosterone, which normally grows as we all age, as that was increasing, the urethra responded differently than it would have. The urethra grew to a point where it shut completely and the animal could no longer pee. BPA took a huge leap forward in people's consciousness this past summer when two key studies came out tying BPA to heart disease and type 2 diabetes. The first of these studies looked at human fat tissue. They looked at what happens when human fat tissue extracted from people in hospitals, what happens when that is exposed to environmentally relevant low levels of bisphenol A. And they looked at the release of adiponectin, which is a protein released by fat. Lots of epidemiological study, long-term gold-plated studies, link adiponectin levels, lower levels, to increased risks of heart attacks and type 2 diabetes in people. So higher adiponectin levels are good, lower are bad. It turns out that adiponectin levels are decreased by bisphenol A right in the zone to which people in this room are carrying in your serum, right at about one part per billion. That study predicts that if we have information about bisphenol A levels in people, we should find an association between bisphenol A, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. Well, after this was published, about a month later in September, in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the first large-scale study, epidemiological study, of people was published. They analyzed CDC data, and they found significant increases in cardiovascular disease, angina, coronary heart disease, heart attacks, and type 2 diabetes in people with elevated levels of bisphenol A. These are not super elevated levels. This is not what you would have if you worked in a factory where they were painting bisphenol A on cans. This is in us. These are levels in us. This is all background levels. The CDC every few years publishes information about average levels of exposure in normal Americans. This analysis is of those people. So low doses of bisphenol A in animals have been looked at across a wide array of health endpoints in those animals. They're now we know we can cause the following these problems in animals: breast cancer, prostate cancer, aneuploidy, which is the error in cell division, early puberty, insulin resistance, obesity, hyperactivity, uterine fibroids, bladder obstruction. You compare some of those effects to human health trends. This is just correlation. This definitely does not prove causation. But it raises a number of very interesting and important public health issues that says that bisphenol A may be involved in the causation, of a wide array of current human health problems. This is a really vital graph. It looks complicated. It's not. The message is very simple. These are a series of experiments, and the black line is the average of those experiments, looking at bisphenol A, estimating the bisphenol A concentrations in mice, in their blood, as a function of time since exposure. In all those experiments, they had adverse effects, some of the types of things I just listed. So those levels of bisphenol A in mouse blood cause problems in mice. How do those levels compare what's in you today, right now? Average level in Americans today is right about there. So don't be confused. This is not about high-dose experiments being used to predict low-dose effects in people. This is about experiments done at concentrations that are directly relevant to the levels in people today in this country. Directly relevant. It's not high-dose extrapolation. I'm going to skip this.
Excuse me for a second. Senator Shaw.
Thank you. Just on that, the last comment you made, maybe I missed it. Were the levels of BPA in mice proportional to the levels that you might find in humans?
For example, the average one part per billion would have
a different effect on a mouse than a person. So were they proportional?
It's scaled for the size of the organisms.
All right. So then what would be the per billion that you would use for a mouse?
No, it is exactly the same concentration.
I see.
It's a tenth of a part per billion in mice compared to a much higher level, about 2 parts per billion in people.
Okay. All right. But it is... you indicate it's proportional to...
Well, the body sizes are different also.
Well, that's what I mean. The body sizes, mouse and person, are different. So is the amount that you tested on the mouse different than...
Well, first of all, I didn't do any of these tests. Okay. These are all peer-reviewed studies published in the scientific literature.
Excuse me, yeah. From the literature, were the dosages...
No, these were absolute doses.
So isn't that unfair?
Not the way that endocrinologists think about this, no.
Because the same dose for a mouse is going to be different for a person.
If I were delivering it to the mouse externally and I were to deliver something that wasn't corrected for weight, these are concentrations from which you correct for the weight of the animal.
Okay. So it is the...
Yeah.
It is proportional.
Yeah, in that sense.
Okay.
Let me skip this slide just for interest of time and say something about the state of government review.
Excuse me just a second. Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're asking a few questions, I just wondered if there's been any link between these kinds of studies and the increase of autism.
There have been studies of that nature. They're much more preliminary than the material I've been talking about. There are some suggestions of changes in brain structure that are somewhat similar to changes in brain structure that take place in a developing autistic child. But it's way too preliminary to speculate about that.
So we should stay tuned.
Excuse me?
Stay tuned,
yeah.
Okay. As it comes.
If we look at the state of government review of BCLA right now, what we learn is that in the late 1990s, Japan encouraged voluntary removal of bisphenol A from a number of products, including the types of changes that you are contemplating here. And they did that. And you go into Japanese stores today, and you don't find bisphenol A in products intended for kids. You find lots of plastic things. You find lots of baby infant formula, but it's in other material. In 2008, Canada banned the use in young children's products. In 2008, the U.S. National Toxicology Program identified that it had some concern for brain development in babies. In August of 2008, the FDA reaffirmed the safety of bisphenol A at current human exposure levels, even though the National Toxicology Program is the formal advisor, scientific advisor to the FDA. So they rejected the National Toxicology Program's advice. And then in October of 2008, the FDA's scientific advisory panel rejected the FDA's conclusion. They said, go back and start over again. And a number of reasons why they did that. Principal ones had to do with the fact that the FDA chose, in its wisdom, to ignore hundreds of academic studies that have been funded by the National Institute of Health, and instead chose to focus its decision on a very small number of industry-funded studies, which independent assessment had showed were flawed. And I could be happy to answer questions about that. And now in March 2009, as a result of these changes in Canada and in the U.S., Europe, which heretofore has considered BPA to be safe, is in March holding a meeting to reassess the safety. So that's at play right now. How did regulatory toxicology miss this? Well, regulatory toxicology uses in its risk assessment a series of assumptions to estimate what acceptable levels of exposure are for people. The most basic of these is that there is a safe exposure level. The second is a little complicated, not too complicated. Basically, it means they assume that the dose makes the poison. They assume that high-dose tests can predict low-dose results. They assume that all dose response curves are going to look like the ones on the left instead of the ones on the right. The ones on the right show where you have this odd pattern of an increasing dose leads to a increased level, but then at even higher levels it drops, which, according to classic toxicology, doesn't happen. That is a crucial assumption built into the belief that high-dose testing can predict low-dose results. Now, importantly, these assumptions are not tested directly. Challenged. Instead, what happens when safety levels are established, what you do is you work down the dose response curve until you find a dose at which there is no effect. Then you introduce a series of safety factors. It sounds entirely reasonable. Tenfold because kids aren't little adults, tenfold because people aren't rats, tenfold because there's individual variation among people. And you usually wind up with a safety factor of about 1,000 beneath what's called the no observed adverse effect level. The NOEL. But that predicted safe level is not tested under current regimes. So, unfortunately, modern endocrinologists, people who practice the medicine of endocrinology, know that what happens at one dose of a hormone can be very different from what happens at another dose of a hormone. They turn on different sets of genes as you go up the dose response curve. So that what happens at one dose can't be predicted by what happens at another. And as scientists have taken that first principle of endocrinology and begun to study hormone-like contaminants, endocrine-disrupting contaminants, they're finding repeatedly these what are called non-monotonic dose response curves, inverted U's or U-shaped dose response curves. And I can explain this to you at greater length. I don't have time right now. But bottom line, this fundamentally says you can't assume the dose makes the poison and use high-dose tests to predict low-dose results. Let me give you one very specific example. Let's do a mind experiment here. How many of you know what tamoxifen is? Tamoxifen is a vitally important pharmaceutical agent, estrogen, anti-estrogen, used to protect women to treat breast cancer, right? Well, you can see from this graph, this shows what happens to the growth of a tumor over a wide range of exposure to tamoxifen. The reason why tamoxifen works to treat breast cancer is because at the high dose range, the parts per thousand, it dramatically suppresses the growth of the tumor. Okay? Look what happens, however, as you work down the dose response curve. There's a zone of concentration of tamoxifen where, in fact, tamoxifen stimulates the growth of the tumor. And physicians know about this. They know what's called the tamoxifen flare. They structure their treatment of women to take that into account. That's why it's really important that a woman not fall off tamoxifen, because it risks having her slip back down that dose response curve until she's in the danger zone. Okay. So let's pretend we're toxicologists setting the safety standard for tamoxifen using these data. First, you identify no observed adverse effect level, no effect. You then introduce a safety factor, tenfold because kids aren't little adults, tenfold because people aren't animals, tenfold because there's individual variation among people. That a factor of 1,000. That puts you directly, squarely in the danger zone. And yet traditional toxicology would have said that's actually the safe zone. That's how all of our regulatory standards have been established. And for compounds like bisphenol A that have dose response curves like this, this is not right. You can't do toxicology in the old way. So I introduced this by saying there were four key discoveries. Some contaminants alter gene expression at really low doses. High-dose experiments don't predict those low-dose effects. Mixtures are ubiquitous. I apologize for not having time to get into that. Adult chronic diseases can be programmed during development. There's some bad news in this. The bad news is that we have allowed widespread exposure to certain types of contaminants into our homes. And the tools we have used, 20th century epidemiology and toxicology, cannot be trusted to find real effect with these complications. But there is good news. And the good news is that a disease under genetic control may be one that is caused by the types of mechanisms that I've talked about today, and it may present us with an opportunity to prevent diseases that heretofore have not been perceived as being preventable. Regulations can be improved, better, safer products and processes can be developed. We've got some challenges ahead of us. There are lots of science that remains to be resolved, lots of it, elegant science. And it's exciting to see the types of new tools that all these molecular geneticists are bringing to bear upon the issues. We know enough now, however, to start incorporating this scientific revolution into a new generation of precautionary health standards, the sort of steps you're contemplating today. Today's health standards are in the scientific Jurassic. That's how old they are. They reflect science built in the 1950s. We can also work at giving better design signals to green chemistry. Chemists are actually hard at work to incorporate these types of considerations into the design of new, less harmful, hopefully benign chemicals. Let me close with two more slides. This is a graph of public health statistics in New York City from 1800 to 1950. And it shows rates of death mostly as a result of waterborne diseases. When public health authorities acted upon these data and changed the face of those public health statistics to dramatically increase people's prospects for life, they didn't understand the intricate details of how viruses and bacteria work. No, they realized good water, great. Dirty water, bad. Let's clean up the water supply. Well, we are entering in it. We're well beyond that stage in this science. I have on this list here a list of today's epidemics for which each of which has plausible links of varying strengths to the types of science I've talked about today. Not all bisphenol A. Bisphenol A is implicated in a lot of them. In none of them is the science certain. Lots more to do. As we move forward in this, my expectation is some of these will drop off the list, but some are going to stay. And as they stay, they're going to give us amazing opportunities to reduce today's healthcare burden for the next generation as people act upon this new science. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Myers. Questions from the committee. Senator Paraso.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it Dr. Myers? Dr. Myers? I wasn't here when you were first introduced. Do you know the results of the study that the university was part of, the University of Minnesota was part of? It was a national study, and it was on tamoxifen, and it recruited people from families that had histories of cancer of some kind. Didn't have to be a victim of cancer, but a history. And they were looking at the dosages versus other kinds of treatments or maybe different medications as well, and you either had maximum dose, a light dose, or you had, what's it called?
Placebos,
yes. And so that was a two-year study, and then they had a resulting one that where they took some of the responders from the first one, the people from the first one, and put them into a different study, and I don't know how that one was structured. So are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that study. The data that I showed you are from the lab at the University of Missouri, and they have to do with human breast tumors in cell culture.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Myers, on one of your earlier slides, juxtaposed to the baby plastic containers was a group of canned foods.
Yes.
A lot of them Campbell's, I recognize, whether
some
it's Campbell's or Swanson's
yes,
broth,
Senator,
whatever.
Campbell's.
What's the connection? By inference, there's something there. Explain that, would
yes,
you?
Yes, Senator. The data we currently have available indicate that about 80% of cans on the U.S. market today are lined with an epoxy rosin that's made out of bisphenol A.
Okay.
And we know from sampling that bisphenol A leaches into the food products within those cans. So it's there. Beginning in the late 1990s, under the voluntary steps that I mentioned earlier, Japan actually took steps to reduce exposures via cans and have actually been able to replace some of the can linings with other materials. But cans are, as far as we know today, cans are a major source of exposure for Americans today.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn, and then I think we'd like to take the opposition testimony and can come back for more discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of brief questions. First, Doctor, in one of your earlier slides that you showed us, you were talking about the kind of the genetic effects, and that in the past we attributed this to hereditary, but you also didn't mention there are additional factors, diet, stress, experience, and then some mm-hmm. environmental concerns. And my question, the first one, is if you look at any kind of genetic event or relationship, which of those eight factors is dominant? In other words, if you're looking at something, is it 90% related to hereditary? And what is the percentage that is controlled or potentially controlled by these environmental factors?
That's an excellent question. And the final answer is a long ways away. We do have some information. For example, if you think about the notorious BRCA1 breast cancer mutation that runs in families in the U.S. and elsewhere, only about 5% of breast cancer cases are attributable to that inherited bad form of the gene. If you look at factors that control that gene's expression, there's a much higher percentage of up to 60 or 70% of breast cancer cases are associated with changes in the factors, changes in key signaling systems that alter that gene's expression. So a much higher fraction of breast cancer is associated with changes in gene expression than differences in inheritance. However, we don't yet know of the factors that have changed gene expression, what percent is diet, what percent is contamination, what percent. We aren't there yet. But that is one of the great questions. And it is the one that will determine what fraction of each of those diseases will be amenable to the sorts of interventions I've talked about.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Dr. Myers, that sort of leads me to the second part of the same question, is that you mentioned that in 1990, I think you said that Japan had made taken steps to eliminate these conditions, and you'd given a list of adult or conditions that potentially were related to this, and I'm wondering if there are effects. I mean, presumably, after 20 years of approximately, you would see lower rates of obesity or lower rates of breast cancer or lower rates of prostate or the other thing that you mentioned in the Japanese population versus the United States population.
Another excellent. That is true. You must be a scientist.
No, I'm not.
The changes in materials began in the late 1990s. The changes in concentration levels were first detected in the early 2000s. Most of these diseases take decades to develop, so we don't. I have not seen data that are consistent with that. I did mention a study of the prediction of the aneuploidy experiment. That was Japanese, and that found that women with higher rates or higher levels of bisphenol A have lower rates of spontaneous miscarriage. But as I mentioned, the sample size is small. The study is being replicated both in Japan and here.
Okay, and finally, just very briefly. And I guess the conclusion I'm drawing from your test was very interesting. I think it to me, and as a non-scientist, I find it interesting and intriguing. But it is a concern to me if we're not able to isolate exactly what percentage of these things might be related to these environmental factors, and that the data we have right now is very incomplete. And that kind of leads me to the last question. And we often deal with issues in the legislature that have some kind of relation to science. And one of the questions often posed is whether or not the view that is being presented represents the consensus of scientific thought. And so my question to you is, does your view, the sort of revolutionary approach to toxicology and that you've described, is that a dominant view in science today, or is what you're presenting really kind of the cutting edge of some things and inviting us to join with you in this? I just your comment
another excellent question. You will learn momentarily that it's not the only view. On the other hand, I think that of the scientists who actively publish on bisphenol A around the world, it's the dominant view, not of people who are funded by industry, however.
Mr. Chairman?
People who are funded by NIH, it's the dominant view.
Dr. Myers, this handout, I don't know if you put this in the packets, that said the studies that were funded by government, 93% found harm from BPA, and the chemical corporation won 0% found harm?
I did not put that in there, but I'm very familiar with those data. Those are accurate to the best of my knowledge. I haven't seen the handout. But that is by far and away the dominant pattern. Industry-funded studies, none of them find adverse effects. The other thing about them is that they often use very old assays that were standardized decades ago, haven't changed since then, and they point to that as a strength. But it's sort of like trying to study the Hubble Space Telescope with binoculars. Excuse me, the distant galaxy with binoculars instead of trying to use the Hubble Space Telescope. The NIH scientists use the Hubble Space Telescope version of assays, and that's why they're finding the types of effects that are reported there.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, is the bisphenol A a stable compound, or is it affected? Now, if it's in food compounds or in containers, there's some transfer of it. Is it affected by heat or cold or freezing or any other things that alter its impact or reduce it or what?
Bisphenol A does degrade over time. Most importantly, it leaves the body over a relatively short period of time, although just within the last week, a new study was published challenging assumptions about the rate at which BPA is metabolized in the body, in adults, and much less so in infants, and almost not at all in fetuses. Bisphenol A is altered into a form that prevents it from causing harm, although that's now being challenged by some new data, particularly the epidemiological information I presented on association in adults with heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and heart attacks.
Should we remove BPA from the lining of plastic bottles and the insides of various cans? Will there then be an exposure to other chemicals or metals or parts of the plastic that we should also be concerned about?
That's an important question. The Japanese have approached that. They're using at least two different molecules that we're aware of to line cans. One of them, actually, we understand right now, is used. That bisphenol A is used to coat the can, but that another plastic with which we have a lot of experience and by the assays I've talked about today appear to be safe, That molecule is used to line the bisphenol A to prevent contact, so that the leakage of bisphenol A is increased by at least 95% in cans built in that way.
So you're saying don't stop.
Decreased. Yeah.
You're not saying stop lining bottles and cans. You're saying don't line them with BPA.
Yeah. I'm also saying there actually are some safe glasses, as far as we know, pretty safe under most circumstances, and glass is not being lined. There are lots of uses of glass that could be brought back into with relatively little harm or little cost.
Thank you very much, Dr. Myers. I would like to call up the opposition witnesses, with Marty Mountford and Steve Henches. While they're coming up, I'll point out that we have Lean Mosler from the League of Women Voters wanted to testify. But we have instead put in the packets her testimony, and I know there are several others who are, I'm sure, supporting and opposed who have put information into the packets. So I will encourage members to read them instead of taking the testimony. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Mountford and Mr. Henges.
Nice to meet you.
Ms. Mumford, would you like to go ahead first? Mr. Henges, please identify yourself and then just go ahead.
Yes, Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to come and talk about SF-247. I'm Dr. Stephen Henges, and I'm here representing the manufacturers of polycarbonate plastic and bisphenol A, the leading global manufacturers of those materials. I'm located at the American Chemistry Council in Arlington, Virginia, although I'm actually a native of Minnesota, born, raised, and educated here. You've heard a little bit about bisphenol A. It's primarily used to make two things, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. Polycarbonate is a clear, shatter-resistant plastic that has a very wide range of uses in our everyday life. For example, products such as CDs and DVDs, eyeglass lenses, components of many medical devices, sports safety equipment such as bicycle helmets, football helmets, and of course it's used in products such as baby bottles and water bottles.
Epoxy resins. Sir, could you use the mic a little closer or
sure.
Angle it up to you or something? Thank you.
Epoxy resins are a completely different kind of material. They're very durable, chemically resistant materials. They have good adhesion, and that makes them very useful as coatings. So you'll find those on, again, a very wide array of products. For example, the corrosion-resistant coating on structural steel or pipes. You'll find it as the primer coating on automotive bodies, and you'll find it also, as you've heard, as the protective coating in most food and beverage cans. And it's used there for a very important public health purpose, because it protects the food from the metal and it protects the metal from the food. Without a coating, we would not have canned foods and beverages as we do now, because the foods and beverages would corrode the metal and contaminate the food. So it serves a very important public health purpose in that application. These are not new materials. Both polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins have been around for about 50 years now, safely used during that time. And over that time, bisphenol A has become one of the best tested of all substances, and you've heard a little bit about that science on bisphenol A already. So we have an extraordinarily rich scientific database to evaluate the safety of bisphenol A. And I'm going to drop to the bottom line here. That safety has been evaluated, that science has been evaluated by numerous government bodies around the world, in particular in the last couple of years. The consensus among regulatory bodies around the world, from the U.S. and Canada to also Japan and Europe, is that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health, in particular at these very low levels, these trace levels that could be present in consumer products and these trace levels that people could be exposed to. And based on these scientific reviews, bisphenol A is not banned or restricted anywhere in the world. Perhaps most notable is the views of the government bodies in Europe. Europe, of course, has adopted the precautionary principle, and we often think of Europe as being the most progressive on these kinds of issues. But in fact, in Europe, the science on bisphenol A has been evaluated very recently. Last year, two different reports have been comprehensively updated. And in Europe, bisphenol A is not banned or restricted. These reviews have not led to any action at all in Europe, quite the contrary to what you might think based on Europe's adoption of the precautionary principle. For example, last year we saw a comprehensive update from the European Food Safety Authority. That's kind of like the European version of FDA, not exactly, but they in particular looked at the safety of bisphenol A in food contact applications, things like baby bottles or canned foods and beverages. And that review very strongly supported the safety of those products. Also last year, we saw a comprehensive update of a risk assessment, not limited to food contact products, but bisphenol A in general. Very consistent conclusions in that assessment, and again, based on that assessment, no actions are being proposed or taken in Europe regarding bisphenol A. Also last year, we've seen individual European countries take a look at the science. For example, we saw statements, these are all from late last year, from the French Food Safety Authority, the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment, and the Danish Environmental Protection Agency. All of these are supporting the safety of bisphenol A. They're all consistent with the reviews that were released by the European Food Safety Authority and the EU. So in Europe, products made from polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins, including such products as baby bottles and canned infant formula, are accepted as safe for use, and they are, in fact, used very widely in Japan. We have other reviews that have come out, for example, that you've heard about the Food and Drug Administration. They have a safety assessment of bisphenol A that is actually underway right now. But the conclusion of their draft assessment, which came out in August last year, stated an adequate margin of safety exists for BPA at current levels of exposure from food contact uses for infants and children. Now, that review is in midstream, so we can't say we know the conclusion. FDA is currently addressing recommendations that came from their science board in the fall of last year. So we'll hear the conclusion from FDA later, but that was their draft conclusion that I just read to you. Also, the Canadian government has taken a very close look at bisphenol A. Their final report came out in the fall of last year, and a bottom-line conclusion from that is that, quote, the current research tells us the general public need not be concerned. In general, most Canadians are exposed to very low levels of bisphenol A. Therefore, it does not pose a health risk. So around the world, we've seen from every regulatory agency that has looked at the science, they're all very consistent. There is a consensus on the safety of bisphenol A at these very low levels to which people might be exposed. Also want to touch on Japan. The Japanese government has carefully looked at bisphenol A as well. They have a very consistent view of the safety of bisphenol A, but I want to address a couple of comments you heard earlier. You heard that about products in Japan. In fact, most food and beverage cans are lined with epoxy resins, very similar to the situation here in Europe and everywhere else in the rest of the world. It is true that canned infant formula in Japan does not contain bisphenol A, but that's for a very simple reason. You won't find canned infant formula in Japan. They don't sell it, but that has nothing to do with bisphenol A. They just don't sell it in Japan. And indeed, polycarbonate baby bottles are sold in Japan. They have a relatively small market share, but they are legal to sell in Japan, and they are available. In addition, the science on bisphenol A has been reviewed by independent scientific bodies. One very good example from last year is an organization called NSF International. It's a not-for-profit public health and safety organization based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Their assessment, which was led by a respected scientist from the California State Department of Toxic Substances Control, published last year in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. That review also very consistent with the views of the government agencies worldwide. So I want to finish just with a brief comment on alternatives to polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. And if you consider the rich scientific database for those materials, for bisphenol A, for polycarbonate, and for epoxy, there are no alternatives that have been tested nearly as well, simply because bisphenol A has been tested so thoroughly and the safety of it has been vetted so carefully by government agencies around the world. So while there are many claims about safer alternatives, those claims cannot be backed up by sufficient data. For example, alternatives for products in baby bottles or other products like that will all presumably meet FDA standards, but so does polycarbonate plastic, so does epoxy resin. So we can say that they all meet FDA standards, but we cannot say that they are safer. There simply is not nearly as much data on any other alternative as there is on bisphenol A. So in closing, I would encourage you to carefully consider the views of the many government agencies around the world that have reviewed the science on bisphenol A, and encourage you to vote no on SF-247. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you briefly today, and I'll take any questions at now or later, however you wish to
thank you, Dr.
run it.
Senator Hahn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, and I'm very concerned here because we just had testimony that maybe I misunderstood, but I was led to believe that the testimony prior said that Japan had banned its product its use in consumer goods. I even asked a question about that, whether that was not disputed, and you're just saying now that that's not true. And I think it's important for the committee to get that clear, whether or not that is in fact or not, and I don't know how that can be done. Maybe you've got some evidence that you can point us to, but we need to know the answer to that, whether or not that statement was made in previous testimony. Is that accurate? Second thing, maybe we can answer to, and I want to be brief here, but in the previous testimony, we were also given some direction to say that research funded by manufacturers and businesses as opposed to research funded in other ways was lined up on one side and the other on the other side. And so you seem to be on the side that says that this has been tested. Are you funded by manufacturers, and do you have that presumably tainted bias that would lead your science to be skewed? Are you getting funding for this research you're reporting on that would be related to that allegation?
Okay, I'll try to remember the first question on Japan. So it is quite correct that bisphenol A and polycarbonate and epoxy resins have not been banned or restricted in Japan. They are quite legal to use there, and again, canned foods and beverages in Japan, the vast majority of those are coated with epoxy resins, very similar to the coatings that are used here and everywhere else around the world. Again, canned liquid infant formula, my understanding, is not sold in Japan at all, so we can't really say anything about that. It's simply not sold in Japan. Other products like baby bottles and other polycarbonate plastic products, again, those have not been banned or restricted. The market share for polycarbonate bottles is relatively low in Japan. Glass, I believe, is really quite high in Japan. But they're legal. They are sold. They are available. There are no bans or restrictions in Japan. Did that cover the Japan question? And we can substantiate all of that as need be. Now, the second one had to do with industry versus other research, I think. Okay, the simple question is, yes, as I said at the beginning, I am here representing the leading global manufacturers of polycarbonate plastic and bisphenol A. So that's who I am, so there's no question about that. On the research, though, let's set aside the industry-sponsored research, and just look at all the rest of the 93% or the 150 studies or whatever the number was. One of the things in science, when you have a lot of data, when you have many studies, in particular when you have conflicting and confusing studies, what scientists do is look at the weight of evidence. They look at all available evidence. And what they're trying to do is to understand, are the findings from these studies, can they be replicated from study to study? Can they be corroborated in similar studies? Are they consistent across the databases, or a coherent story that comes out of those studies? That's what the government agencies have done, the ones who have reviewed the science. And there are some problems that come up. For example, you find that findings that have been reported in one study cannot be replicated in other studies that attempt to do the same thing. They cannot be corroborated in other similar studies. And here's a couple examples. You heard about fat mice a little bit earlier. Well, there are many dozens, probably somewhere over 70 studies that have looked for effects of bisphenol A on body weight. The vast majority of them find no effects. So there's no consistent finding there. You also heard about aneuploidy in one study that was published a number of years ago reporting effects of low levels of bisphenol A on aneuploidy. That finding has not been replicated by a team of researchers in Europe, highly qualified researchers who could find no evidence for that finding at all. So this has been a problem that is endemic in the literature on bisphenol A. Replication and corroboration is not there. And if a basic tenet of science is that if you cannot replicate a finding, if you cannot repeat it in a separate lab, you cannot rely on it as being valid. And that is part of the basis for why government bodies around the world do not find this science to be compelling, and none have taken action based on it. Maybe a little more than you wanted to hear, but did that touch it?
Senator Rummel.
I just wanted to clarify that the previous testimony said that in Japan, the linings of cans have another protectant that keeps the bisphenol A. So it's almost like you have three layers. You have the can, you have the BPA, and then you have another layer that keeps the BPA from leaching into the cans.
That's to clarify that is true for a minority of cans in Japan, and that technology is only suitable for certain applications. I think you'll hear some testimony later from Dr. John Ross, who will be much better at answering questions on cans. But that technology is very limited. It cannot work across the board. It can only work in certain products.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
So, and then following up on that, has BPA been banned in Canada for the purposes of lining cans and bottles?
Thank you. I skipped over that before. I'd intended to cover that. In Canada, I read you the, I think I read the quote about their bottom line conclusion on the science, where they found, concluded that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health, including infants and children. What they've decided to do, though, or what I should say they're talking about, is they are considering, on a precautionary basis, to ban polycarbonate baby bottles, but only baby bottles. And they've made it very clear that they have no concerns for any other polycarbonate products, any other containers or cups or whatever. For canned foods, they're not proposing to ban anything. And what they are doing is they are working with the industry on a voluntary basis to make sure that the levels of bisphenol A in canned infant formula are minimized at the lowest level possible, but they're not proposing to ban any canned products in Canada.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Hedges, that wasn't my question. I didn't ask about whether the bottles or the cans had been banned. My question is, has BPA, the use of BPA in lining bottles and cans, been banned in Canada?
No.
Is there a requirement that the BPA lining be then subsequently be lined with another substance in Canada? Is there that type of requirement?
No, there is not. You know, epoxy can coatings are, again, they're legal, quite legal in Canada. They're universally used, just like they are here and pretty much everywhere else around the world.
Epoxy using BPA?
Correct. Epoxy resin is made from bisphenol A. Yeah.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hinges. Following Senator Hamm's line of questioning, you were saying that you said you were a representative of the American Chemical Council. Is that right?
Correct. And specifically work with the leading global manufacturers of bisphenol A polycarbonate plastic.
Okay. So you're an employee of that organization?
Correct.
And could you tell us about the Chemistry Council? Who are members of that?
Well, the American Chemistry Council, the members are the leading chemical manufacturers in the United States. But what I do specifically is I work with the global manufacturers of bisphenol A and polycarbonate plastic.
Could you tell this group who those producers are? I'm not sure who they are.
Of
chemicals.
All chemicals? That's a lot.
This particular one.
For bisphenol A. There are only a handful of those. There are five companies in North America. Those are Bayer, Dow, Sanoco Chemicals, Hexion Specialty Chemicals, and SABIC Innovative Plastics. There are other companies globally, in particular in Asia.
One more follow-up question, Mr. Chair. And where are those producers located? Do we have any in Minnesota?
Not of the producers of those materials, bisphenol A, polycarbonate, or epoxy. There's only a handful of manufacturing plants in North America. They're not in Minnesota. So here, there would be polycarbonate companies that would process polycarbonate plastic or epoxy resins to make an end product, but not the raw materials themselves.
Thank you. After Senator Olson, I'm going to encourage us to have the other three witnesses so we can keep moving, and then maybe some of the questions will be answered. But Senator Olson, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and my question may, as you inferred, another testifier might have a better answer for it, and so I hope that he's listening. The compound that of the resins that is used to line cans or as a part of the baby bottles, how stable is that, and does it vary with the food product or the product that's in the can as to whether it causes that BPA to move into the food stuff, or how stable is it? You know, you mentioned that without a coating, food does interact with other forms of metal, and you either have the rusting out of the cans or you have contaminants that affect the food. Is this more stable? Obviously, it's more stable. You wouldn't be bothering to line the cans, but just how much research has been done as to what may cause that to leave what you would think is a fairly stable product and enter into the food?
I'll give you maybe the first half of the answer for epoxy resin can coatings and leave more details. Hold that question to Dr. Ross, who will know more about it. But epoxy resins, one of their attributes is that they are chemically very stable. They are very chemically resistant, so they don't break down. So once that coating is applied to a can or anything else, whether it's structural steel or whatever, that coating is quite stable and does not break down. I don't know enough to say if there's differences, though, for different food types, so maybe hold that part of the question, okay. Different processing questions or different food
Thank
types.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hinges. Ms. Mountford.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would just like to, before I get started, mention that the infant formula manufacturers don't make the cans that the liquid product is put in. So just for context, if it's possible, we might want to let Dr. Ross speak next, because I'm not going to focus on the can part of it. I'm going to focus more on the implications for that for the formula industry. But okay. But it's up to you. So
why don't you, because you're sitting there, we'll have okay. Dr. Ross come next. But
okay,
why
that's
why don't
you
fine.
Just go ahead. My name is Marty as well, by the way. And I am Executive Vice President of the International Formula Council, known as IFC, which is the Association of Infant Formula Manufacturers and manufacturers of other nutrition products like adult medical foods. Our members are predominantly based in North America, and our members include Abbott, Mead Johnson, and Nestle, who manufacture the majority of the infant formula that is produced in this country. The IFC respectfully opposes SF-247. We believe that the currently available scientific evidence does not justify a BPA ban in products for infants and children and young children. Moreover, if this bill is enacted, it would drastically reduce the availability of infant formulas for the thousands of Minnesota families who safely feed their babies this product. As Dr. Hinch has stated, no government agency anywhere in the world has banned BPA in food packaging to date. He reviewed the conclusions of many of these groups, so I'm not going to repeat that, but I would just add one that he didn't mention, and that's that the World Health Organization has found no basis to issue health warnings about BPA. Now, the primary focus of IFC, the association, as well as our member companies, is the health and welfare of babies and children. And the product that we manufacture, infant formula, is the most highly regulated food in the entire world. It continues to be the only safe alternative to breast milk. So the infant formula industry takes all potential safety issues very seriously, and we support science-based efforts to produce infant formula products of the highest possible quality. The materials used in formula packaging meet all current regulatory standards. When new information becomes available on substances like BPA, we support bringing that information forward through the accepted process of scientific peer review, regulatory review, and evaluation. In the meantime, we work in collaboration with government and regulatory authorities to protect the health and safety of infants. Now, as part of this commitment, and in response to consumer and changing consumer and customer preferences, we stand ready to adopt suitable alternatives that meet or exceed the benefits of the current packaging materials. So while the scientific evidence continues to support the safety of BPA, our industry is partnering with the food packaging suppliers to first minimize the trace levels that might be contained in the current packaging. And the way we're doing that is by changing our manufacturing and filling processes to bring BPA exposure and migration levels down to the lowest possible levels. Simultaneously, we're working with the packaging industry, as well as the FDA and the Canadian government, to research and identify possible alternatives. Now, each of these steps takes time, however, and switching to an alternative packaging is not a simple process, and it could take years. Just the way that the packaging suppliers have to work with regulators, they have to identify and certify and make these available alternatives. Our industry has to go through a number of steps to ensure that any new material continues to provide at least the same quality and safety provided by the current materials, and this takes time. So today's packaging provides the crucial protection that's needed to maintain the quality of the product and to maintain it over a given period of time known as shelf life. And for the liquid products, that is generally around 12 to 18 months. So the epoxy liners in the metal cans protect the product from the metal can and also from other environmental factors like light and temperature. But then these protections are also critical in preventing corrosion or environmental contamination, and they have to also ensure the nutrient stability and aesthetic features like flavor and aroma throughout the product's shelf life. So the FDA requires that all of these factors have to be accounted for when a manufacturer decides to change a packaging option. So although it'd be nice to be able to speed up this process, the reality is they're really, you can't really speed it up, and it takes years. So even once you find a package that is viable, an alternative, there are still other steps to take. The manufacturers have to modify their production lines in a variety of ways, and that's going to vary depending on the manufacturer and what they already have in place. And it's safe to say, though, that all of them would have to make some changes. So in addition to minimizing the BPA migration and seeking suitable alternatives, we have encouraged the FDA and the Canadian government to explore establishing, first of all, a uniform safe level for BPA and infant formula products and a validated testing methodology. And they are addressing these important issues because the public remains confused and concerned about this issue, largely because of some of the conflicting reports about the safety of BPA, which you've heard already today. Dr. Hinch has mentioned, that many of these studies that have shown health effects, there have been attempts made to replicate the studies, and that has not been possible yet. So there is a great amount of confusion about this. So we have encouraged the FDA to set this safety level and also the testing method so that people are using the same method and you can compare results more realistically. Now, the proposed bill, SF-247, would result in a reduction in the number and forms of formula products that are available to consumers in this state. And even with a compliance date of 2013, which sounds generous, when you look at what has to be done to adopt an alternative, even if there's one available, it's quite a challenge, and it might not be completed by 2013. So what we believe is that what the Canadian Health Minister has stated, we support that the benefits of continuing to make the liquid products, infant formulas, available while working to minimize the exposure, that best serves the public interest. In summary, consistent with the current scientific consensus on the safety of BPA, and to preserve Minnesota parents and caregivers' infant feeding options, we urge this committee to defer further action on SF-247. As I've said, if enacted, this bill might necessarily restrict the choice of formulas that are currently available to the moms in this state. And there are well-established national and international processes that are in place for evaluating the safety of products and substances such as BPA. And we encourage the committee to allow this scientific and regulatory review process to be completed before taking any action on this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions if anybody has some.
Thank you, Ms. Mugford. Mm-hmm. I think I'll call right away Dr. Ross. Is that you? Okay. And I'll have Mr. Fisk come up next as well. Then we can have more questions.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. John Rost. I'm here today representing the North American Metal Packaging Alliance, NAMPA. I'm pleased to be able to testify today. NAMPA is a nonprofit corporation committed to the safety of metal packaging and metal packaged foods. For over 50 years, epoxy coatings have been used safely in metal food packaging. Bisphenol A, or BPA, is a critical component of the manufacture of epoxy coatings. The combination of toughness, adhesion, formability, and resistance to the wide range of chemistries found in foods and beverage products today, and the ability to sustain the high temperature required for sterilization, makes the coating of choice. as it has been for decades, with performance that is unsurpassed. The use of epoxy coatings in metal packaging is the most effective way to protect the food product. Metal cans ensure food safety by enabling high-temperature heat sterilization that eliminates the dangers of food poisoning from microbiological contaminants. Metal cans are essential for bringing nutritious, wholesome foods to people throughout the world because they dramatically increase shelf life and decrease food waste due to product expiration. Moreover, no other food packaging performs as well in situations such as disaster response, homeland security, or famine relief. Any legislation that has the ultimate effect of banning or limiting the use of BPA-based epoxy coatings ignores the scientific evaluations conducted by regulatory agencies around the world and will have serious unintended consequences that compromise public health. The use of epoxy coatings has been determined to be safe by numerous science-based regulatory agencies, including Health Canada, the US FDA, the European Food Safety Authority, as well as national health agencies in the United Kingdom, Germany, and Japan. The simple fact is that there is no readily available, suitable alternative to BPA-based can coatings that meets the essential safety and performance requirements for the broadest spectrums of foods now packaged in metal containers. Commercial applications of alternatives in development even today remain years away from market implementation. Restrictions on the use of epoxy coatings for metal packaged foods will have the unintended consequences beyond compromising food safety. With the advent of epoxy coatings, the shelf life of metal packaged food has doubled. This means less food waste and greater conservation of resources. For example, less energy needs to be consumed to meet the same food demand, among other societal benefits that must be considered in this debate. As many of you know, the US FDA at this time is reviewing again the safety of BPA-based epoxy coatings. NAMPA urges the state of Minnesota to consider this review in its deliberation. The FDA is the most competent entity to engage in this review, and any decision by the state should be informed by and consistent with the judgments of those scientists best able to assess the merits of any concerns with the use of BPA-based epoxy resins. The citizens of the state of Minnesota should not be subject to less protective standards of care with respect to food safety than others in the U.S. Metal packaging of foods continues to be one of the safest and most sustainable ways to deliver food to the world, and we encourage the members of the committee to reject their proposed legislation. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. Mr. Fisk, you want to go ahead, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kevin Fisk of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. The GMA is the leading association of food, beverage, and consumer product companies in the world. We have a number of facilities here in the state of Minnesota, 54. We represent the entire food and beverage and consumer product industry. Unfortunately, being last means that most of the folks who've come before me have hit many of the points that I would like to have made, but I'd like to just shore up a couple of things that we as an organization believe and follow very closely those regulations and guidelines and the studies and approval given to bisphenol A by the Food and Drug Administration, by the European Food Safety Authority, and by the World Health Organization. They've all evaluated bisphenol A, as you've heard, and approved the safety of the chemical as a food contact substance. The extensive studies that they have done have shown to us in the food industry that it is a safe contact substance that we can use in the canning of many foods and beverages, that there really is no alternative for, no safe, reliable alternative. And you've heard it mentioned that any attempt to get an alternative will take a number of years. But I want you to think about one thing. An alternative for one product or one application doesn't mean it will work for something else. It may work for tomatoes, but it may not work for pineapple. Or it may not work for a variety of other things. Each product has to be tested to see what sort of interaction that it will have with the lining or the coating within that can. That takes a great deal of time, and the ones that we've some of our members have taken a look at so far. Those testing are saying that it's going to take 5 to 7 years to look at one application. That's one possible alternative for one application. As an association, we're strongly in favor of risk analysis approach taken by the national and international regulatory agencies around the world to evaluate BPA and other chemicals, quite frankly, as long as they are scientifically sound and appropriate. We are opposed to this legislation in that the national and international regulatory authorities have all been consistent in telling us that BPA is safe for use in food and beverage products as we use them today.
Thank you, Mr. Fisk. Questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm looking at an article dated December 16th, 2008. It appeared in the Washington Post. And it reports that the FDA was criticized. I'll just read it. It says, the Food and Drug Administration criticized by its own scientific advisors for ignoring available data about health risks posed by a chemical found in everyday plastic. Said over the past decade, more than 130 studies have linked BPA to breast cancer, obesity, diabetes, neurological problems, and other disorders. And its own panel says that the agency's position on BPA was scientifically flawed. Panel, keep in mind this is the FDA's own scientific panel, said the agency should revisit its assessment and take into account the studies it had ignored. And as a result, the FDA is saying it's going to be performing additional analysis that may take some months or years. So I'm wondering if the testifier could respond to this report and your citation that the FDA has declared it safe, yet its own scientific advisors are telling us that they've ignored the evidence, and they're going to, and the FDA itself is going to take another look at BPA.
Which one?
Either.
Well, essentially, what FDA has done, and it's a very transparent process, is they have embarked on a new risk assessment for bisphenol A, and as part of that process, their original draft assessment, again, it's a draft, concluded that it was safe. But to be thorough, they asked a committee of the Science Board to review that assessment. The Science Board has come back and made recommendations and said, we want you to look at those studies again. Now, mind you, those studies that they're asking them to look at again are ones that have been looked at time and time again by the European Food Safety Authority, the Japanese, Health Canada, and come to the same conclusion. So they will review those studies again based on that recommendation from the Science Board and come to a decision on the safety or the risk assessment of BPA. So they're not performing a secondary risk assessment.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, the scientific panel says the FDA ignored all the studies and all the research and has told the FDA to go back and take a look at the research that they ignored. So I don't think they've been looking at research time and time again. If their own panel of scientists are saying that the FDA is ignoring available data about health risks, I would say that perhaps the FDA did not do its due diligence. So I don't take comfort in the citations of the FDA that are repeated in your testimony. And I also believe that it's important when the FDA and the federal government fails to act, it's important for states to act where the federal government fails to. It often gives rise to the sorts of changes we need at the federal level.
Right, but to be consistent, this is something that has been reviewed by many regulatory agencies around the world and has been determined to be safe by the European Food Safety Authority, who's looked at all of the studies, the Japanese, the United Kingdom, Germany, as well as Canada. And they've all come to the same conclusion. So this isn't just FDA on its own saying one thing. This is a view consistent with regulatory agencies around the world.
Well, Mr. Chair, I keep hearing about the FDA, and I was responding to that specifically.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The studies that we heard initially focus on the compound bisphenol A by itself and its impact. I think the focus here is on two different compounds the ones that are used in the material that lines cans and in some forms of plastic. How is there a difference between the two in terms of the stability, the question that I raised before, the stability of that particular material as a part of either the can lining material or within the plastic? Does that escape more readily from either of those materials?
Well, bisphenol A is a starting material to making two different components. One is an epoxy resin, which is used to line cans, and has slightly different chemistry makeup in that polymer. The other is to make polycarbonate plastic, that tough, clear plastic. There is slightly different chemistries. I'll speak to the epoxy resins, which my members use. Essentially, when it is put onto a metal can, it is chemically stable. BPA does not, or epoxy resins do not break down to give you any free BPA once it's manufactured. The only BPA that can migrate into food is those very, very trace residual of unreacted BPA used to make the polymer. With all chemical reactions, nothing reacts to 100%. So there are trace residuals of unreacted BPA. BPA does not break down in epoxy liners to give you free BPA.
How about in the plastic bottles?
That's generally true. Under extremely harsh conditions, it can break down. With very, very caustic chemicals, it can break down, but it's, again, at very, very low levels.
Just if I might follow up, somebody sent me an email that the dangers of freezing a bottle of water in a plastic bottle, that something comes out of the plastic and contaminates the water and terrible things happen. Is that what this compound, or
no,
what in the world is that about?
That's one of those internet myths, that freezing bottled water will give you dioxin. It's chemically impossible. I don't think anybody would argue that, but that's an internet myth, and
legend.
And generally they're talking about a different type of polymer.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Keel asked a whole lot of questions. I'd like to ask members to keep the questions as quick as we can so we can get through them all. Senator Keel.
Two questions, one for Senator Rommel, and that is, are there any other states looking to ban this?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. Yes, there are 11 other, I think there's 14 other states working on this bill. I'd like to clarify, this bill is not about cans and the lining of cans. This bill is about baby toys, baby bottles, sippy cups, and about packaging for infant formula. And currently, there are more than one way to package infant formula. You do not have to put infant formula in a can. So let's be really clear that we are not talking about your tomato soup on the shelf or the canned corn or anything like that. This is a very limited bill for little bodies who react disproportionately to minute amounts of that bisphenol A that leaches either from the plastic or from the lining of infant formula cans. The hormonal action of these minute amounts of bisphenol A can have drastic changes on the genetic structure of those children, can actually rearrange the order in which certain things happen. So let's be clear that I'm not have not nothing to do with these folks who are testifying here. It's a very limited bill for a very limited population.
My other question is to Dr. Ross, and that is, BPA has been around for 50 years, and cans have been around for 150. What did you use prior to that to keep the canned stuff from rusting the cans?
Well, there's been a lot of technologies, very old technologies. Prior to epoxies, a great number of cans were actually tin-coated, and that's just not possible today due to the availability of tin, nor would there be any consumer preference for that. So that's not even a possibility to go back to that. There are other technologies that are used for certain niche markets. epoxies are used in the vast majority of metal packaging because of the requirements of performance. There are certain applications where it's not required and it's not used. So, again, going back to the previous technology is just not a viable option.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My answer of the how many states have been involved in that attempting to pass this legislation was answered. Thanks.
Thanks. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rummel, for getting us back on the focus of the bill. It's been very interesting hearing some of the consequences that may ripple around the bill. But it seems to me that this committee has had the same kind of testimonies we had last year when you brought the rubber ducky bill. And, you know, we here as a committee are subject to conflicting evidence, scientific studies supporting both sides, and extensive research supporting both sides. And we're even subject to internet myths. And I don't know if there are any chemists here at the table, people that really understand this from an extremely deep perspective. So we're left with the same question as we had last year. In the face of conflicting evidence, who do we choose to support and protect? Children or giant chemical companies? And that is what the question is before us today.
Senator Sieben, your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. First, I think it's important to note that there are alternatives for BPA products. For instance, when my own son was born last year, I knew about this research and purchased BPA-free bottles to use for him. And so major manufacturer or major retailers like Babies R Us, Walmart, do now carry BPA-free products. So I just want the committee members to be aware that that is an alternative, even though some of the testimony makes it sound like if we would pass this legislation, there'd be no baby products left in Minnesota. I think that the real, perhaps if I, and you can mistake or correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Rummel, but it seems as though the real debate is over that lining of just liquid infant formula cans. That's not correct. Or for formula cans for baby food, and that's what you, that's what where some of the opposition is coming from.
I think, I'm as I said when I opened up, I came here on behalf of constituents who called my office concerned about these chemicals. In terms of the sippy cups and the baby bottles, yes, there are alternatives on the shelves, but they're not clearly marked, all of them. And some places you can go, for example, Toys R Us, and know that, hey, it's cool to shop here. Other places are not. So the bill addresses that confusion in the public. As far as the infant formula, it's the packaging. There are alternative ways to package besides cans. And the reason we specified 2013 for the application is to allow people who deliver or who package infant formula to find an alternative packaging. They don't have to find an alternative liner to cans, just an alternative way to package infant formula. We're not touching any of the cans and the lining in cans.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And if I could just follow up, I was wondering if Dr. Myers could speak again about any science that he has on the transfer of BPA from products like plastic baby bottles into liquid.
There are extensive studies by scientists, both based at universities as well as at industry. DuPont, for example, has published on this. Polycarbonate plastic made out of bisphenol A is actually not stable over time. It degrades in the presence of slight increases in acidity, increases in heat, not the extreme conditions that we referred to earlier. But in relatively mild conditions, bisphenol A
breaks down. The bonds that bind the molecules together degrade, and bisphenol A is leached into food products with which it comes into contact. There are extensive data published on this.
Thank you. And if I could just add a non-scientific comment here. As a new mother, I've been in contact with other new mothers, and families are concerned that the products that they're using are not safe. And it seems to me that it is the role of the state, where there's conflicting evidence at worst, but perhaps more conclusive evidence that's just not in all cases being considered by some of our regulatory agencies, that it is in the best interest of states like Minnesota to take action to protect children. So just like to add that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Dr. Myers a question. Earlier it was stated that we referred to about 189 independent peer-reviewed studies, and the statement was made that those findings were not replicable. Could you comment on that, Dr. Myers?
I'd be happy to comment on that. When you look at that table that you have in the folder, again, I didn't provide that, but if you look at it, you will find that none. I don't have it in front of me. Does it say 13 industry studies have found none?
It says 14 funded by the industry and 204 funded by government.
If you look, analyses have been asked, why are the industry-funded studies not capable of replicating the academic studies? Most of it comes down to two issues, either the choice of the animal model, the strain of rat, and time after time, industry studies have chosen a strain of rat or mice known ahead of time not to be sensitive to estrogen, not to be sensitive. They go ahead and they do the study, and they find, oh, it doesn't respond to estrogen. And they say, we can't replicate the results. What that really indicates is they structured their experiment in a way that it wouldn't find the results. And I would introduce into, for your consideration, an article that appeared this month in a mainstream media magazine called Fast Company. It is by an investigative reporter, and the headline of that is, or the tagline of the article, is how a handful of consultants used Big Tobacco's tactics to sow doubt about science and hold off regulation of BPA, a chemical in hundreds of products that could be harming an entire generation. Choosing animals that are insensitive to run your experiments on is a classic tactic used to ensure that there will be negative results. Those results are then thrown into the literature and then pointed to as a demonstration, oh, it's not consistent. In some of these cases, it's entirely understandable why they couldn't be reproduced. The experiments were deeply flawed. And in one specific case, if I may go on, the gold standard test that or experiment that's been held up by the FDA as a demonstration that these results are not replicatable, in hearings before the FDA in September, it was shown that in that experiment held forth by the FDA and industry as demonstrative proof that replicability was not possible, it was shown that the experiment was so deeply flawed that it shouldn't have been published. If I may go on for a moment, I can explain exactly what happened.
Mr. Chair,
this
may I just interrupt for a moment,
yes.
Mr. Chair? We're about 2 minutes from the end of the committee meeting, as I recall. Isn't it 2:45? And I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, how much longer we're going to go on and what's the plan for voting, because we all have other appointments, I'm sure, that we'd like to get to.
Senator Fischbach, good question. We are going to go till 3 o'clock. We are hoping to get the other bills. We will not be voting on it today if you have to get going to another.
Mr. Committee. Chair, we won't be voting on either bill?
No, on neither bill. We're planning to adjourn the joint committee and have our committee vote on it, but we will not have time for that. But we are going to take Senator Hand and Senator Chaudhry wanted to comment on this or ask questions, and then I'd like to get to the other bill quickly because they have some, I believe, an out-of-town witness, and I believe the testimony on that bill is much shorter than to this one.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I do have to go because we were
that.
Scheduled at 2:45, and I
here.
Noticed we've lost a few other folks
right.
here since
we will not be voting.
On.
So thank you. Senator, go ahead. Will you finish?
The bottom line of this experiment is they were attempting to detect a 35% increase in prostate weight. That would have been a positive result. Their control animals had prostates 70% bigger than everyone else's controls. It was a completely flawed experiment, and yet the FDA chose that as the gold standard for their science. This is one of the reasons why the FDA's advisory body said, go back to the drawing boards. You've really screwed up.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I just have to comment because I'm troubled by your argument and what you're saying. Understanding correctly, please correct me. But what you're suggesting is that there's a whole bunch of scientists from multiple agencies, including the government, that knowingly engage in bad science, knowing that they're choosing methods and choosing ways that are going to yield false results. And they're presumably doing this for some reason, you know, maybe it's to make money or something. But that's the allegation that you're sort of building your case on, is that there are a whole bunch of scientists that work for different organizations and the federal government that are intentionally deceiving the public to do it wrong. And I find that to be incredible.
Do you trust the FDA, based on its record over the last 2 years in protecting American consumers? May I specifically, there's a congressional investigation underway right now that is partly a result of investigations by investigative journalists based at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who found that some of the FDA reports was actually written by industry consultants.
And Mr. Chairman and Doctor, with all respect, I'm not saying that anybody is perfect here, but I am saying that there is a process that exists, and you're asking us to disbelieve any of it and trust you. And I don't know anything about you either.
Right.
And all I'm getting at is, it seems to me to be fairly incredible to ask the committee to say, all these people are engaged in a knowing conspiracy to do the public harm. That's all I'm getting at. And I think that's the burden of your testimony. And I think to get us to that point, you're going to have to present an awful lot of data and information to substantiate that. But I have not heard.
I do not know why those choices were made as to what animal models to use. I know that they were inappropriate. I know that they biased the experiments to the null. They virtually guaranteed that the experiments would come out negative.
Senator Dahl was in on that point.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that dollars are a very strong motivator in just about for anybody. And one of the things we could do here with this particular issue, instead of trying to debate which study was right, maybe we should just put a label on the baby's toys and saying there's been evidence showing that BPA has been harmful, and let the individual who's buying those products make a decision with their pocketbook where they want to spend their money. And then we won't have to debate whether or not these studies were valid or not.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think I found some clarity on the what countries have banned BPA, at least for the purposes of Canada. I'm reading their Canadian Health Ministry, Health Canada, and it says October 17, 2008, the government of Canada today announced it will immediately proceed with drafting regulations to prohibit the importation, sale, and advertising of polycarbonate baby bottles that contain bisphenol A. The government will also take action to limit the amount of bisphenol A that is being released into the environment. I think some of the citations from the government ministers and some of the materials we saw from the testimony referred to comments relating to BPA in cans, in formula cans. So it doesn't appear like Canada has banned BPA in cans, but they are. It appears that they are taking action to limit how much goes in some way, shape, or form. And the statement says the government of Canada will immediately proceed with drafting regulations. So perhaps the ban isn't in place at the moment, but it appears that they have decided that it will be banned and they're implementing those regulations. I'm reading this from the Health Canada, Health Department of Health Canada
press release website. So I'm not, and I read the entire sentence. So I'm not paraphrasing. And then just one last thing. It does say that in the same release, the scientists concluded in this assessment that BPA exposure to newborns and infants is below levels that cause effects. However, due to the uncertainty raised in some studies relating to potential effects of low levels of BPA, the Government of Canada is taking action to enhance the protection of infants and young children. And then it goes on about some environmental issues, and maybe we'll take a look at that in closer detail in the Environment Committee too. But I just wanted to clarify that part. I'm not. I didn't have a chance to research the Japan question.
Could I clarify?
Japan? And that I believe, Senator Rummel, that's what your bill does, is follow the baby bottle ban, sippy cups and bottles.
I didn't say Japan had banned. I said they had asked for voluntary. Ask industry to stop using it on a voluntary basis.
Okay.
There's no. I agree with Dr. Henches. There is no ban in Japan, but there has been a large-scale shift away from the use of bisphenol A in products intended for infants.
Senator Rummel, did you have one last paragraph of comments, and then we can move on to the other bill for 10 minutes?
I simply wanted to thank all of you for giving us the time and attention, and for those of you who hung in through the end, I really appreciate it. I do believe this is an important piece of legislation we need to consider. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Scheidt, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a request of the maybe the advocates or someone. I think this information about this panel, this scientific panel at the FDA rebuking the agency for excluding so much of the evidence is important. And so if someone could maybe give us a summary of that panel's report and its findings and why, you know, why they're so concerned about this at least initial action that the FDA has taken with respect to BPA.
Senator Rummel, if you can get that information, that'd be appreciated.
Thank you.
Senator Scheidt, you've only, unfortunately, only have 8 or 9 minutes in a small audience, but I think maybe we should go ahead and take the testimony here. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman. This Senate File 225 is a bill called the Toxic Free Kids Act. And I've been in the room. I've been listening to the testimony that you've just had on Senator Rummel's bill, which I do support. And I would say, though, that the way this differs is that this establishes a system in our state that's going to move away from trying to regulate chemicals one after the other. And it tries to set up a process, a system for the PCA to prioritize chemicals. This is all pertaining to children's products. And we would phase out products only or something that has a high level of serious, you know, questions about it, where the PCA has decided, and it's called, there is terminology in the bill, but it would be a priority chemical of high, a chemical of high concern. We would phase that out only when there are safer alternatives available. So this would require the PCA to work with the Department of Health. I don't know if you want to go through the bill now. I assume we're going to have another hearing, and that at that time I
when
can go through
be,
the detail of
right.
the bill, because I, you know, am
it would
prepared
be if
to
we
do
could
that.
Get a little bit of testimony.
I would,
in
okay.
Of that. Yeah.
I think that that kind of is the gist of
summary
this
of
bill.
Thank you, Ms. Schuler.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Schuler. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm also co-director of Healthy Legacy. And you heard about Healthy Legacy. We're a statewide public health coalition, and we're concerned with eliminating the use of toxic chemicals in consumer products, especially where children are exposed. This is a public health issue that's been acknowledged by the American Public Health Association, who has a resolution on chemical policy reform, and also by the Minnesota Public Health Association. And there's a letter in your packet, a letter of support from the Minnesota Public Health Association, who's part of our coalition.
Why are we working in the state level? We're working in the state level because the federal government has failed to address this problem. The Toxic Substances Control Act, which is a 32-year-old law regulating industrial chemicals, fails to require safety testing before products are introduced and has only regulated five chemicals in its long history. In January 2009, the GAO report noted that the overhaul of TSCA should be a top priority because of EPA's inadequate process in assessing toxic chemicals, as it significantly hampers its ability to protect human health and the environment. And there's an article in your packet from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that talks about this GAO report and why it's important that TSCA be reformed. The Toxic Free Kids Act offers a systematic way to evaluate chemicals in children's products as a place to start. It's not going to solve all the problems, but if we start with children, the most vulnerable population, we can move in the direction of working on all chemicals. So the Pollution Control Agency would consult with the Minnesota Department of Health, and they would generate a list of chemicals of high concern. These would be chemicals that are known carcinogens, that are reproductive or developmental toxins, that are hormone disruptors, that are brain or immune toxin, or that are known to be persistent or bioaccumulate in the environment, in wildlife, in food, and in the human body. The PCA wouldn't have to start from scratch because there's existing lists that are out there that have been generated by other states and other agencies. They would also participate in Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse, and they have signed on to participate in this clearinghouse, which is established at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and it would be a repository for states to share data on chemical characteristics and alternatives assessment, so they wouldn't have to conduct costly research here in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to ask the last two witnesses, are either of you from out of town, and it'd be...
Yes.
Well, could you go ahead?
Yes, sir, but I'm going to be here tomorrow, so I'm good.
Oh, we're not going to be dealing with it tomorrow, so if you can come now, we'd appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Kathleen Roberts. I am with the American Chemistry Council. As Dr. Henches had mentioned earlier, the Chemistry Council is a trade association that represents the leading chemical companies in the United States. We're engaged in the business of chemistry. Our members apply the science of chemistry to make innovative products and services that make people's lives better, healthier, and safer. Mr. Chair, I recognize time is of the essence, so I don't think I'll go through all the points that are highlighted here in front of me. What I'd like to say is that ACC certainly supports the objective that's outlined in this proposed legislation. We recognize the importance of protecting children from potentially harmful exposures to chemicals. We support improved transparency for information that's out there so that people can make informed decisions, whether it be parents or the government or healthcare professionals. What we would suggest is, though, for a practical and pragmatic approach, there is a list of priority chemicals that are out there, but even with that, it's a long list. And what we would encourage the people who are drafting the legislation to consider is, simply because a chemical is hazardous doesn't mean that it poses a risk unless there is exposure. So as you're looking at the children's products, determine what is the level of the chemical in that product. Is the chemical actually able to leave the product, or is it bound in a matrix? And then determine whether real exposure occurs. And then apply limited resources, and they seem to be getting more and more limited as the days go by, to those chemicals that are the highest priority. That's an effective and efficient way of using information that's there. We're also concerned with the alternative assessments and perhaps the process that's outlined. Right now, an alternative is a substitute process, product, material, chemical, strategy, or combination thereof that is a functional equivalent. Whether something is a functional equivalent doesn't address whether it's the same quality, has the same feasibility, presents any different risks that perhaps were not posed by the first set of chemicals in the product. So, for example, you may have a plastic that has a residue that's left in it And that plastic is used to make a car seat. You could find a substitute plastic without that residue, but is that plastic as strong? Is it as durable? Will it be able to withstand the impact that you might run into into a car accident? So you don't want to replace potentially one problem with a different problem. I guess the last thing I would point out is there's an assumption that chemicals that are used in a myriad of different children's products have the same functional equivalent or same use pattern. So simply because you look at a chemical and say we want to use an alternative for this one chemical, it may not work in all the products that are out there. So you'll have to do an assessment product by product by product, and that could take a long time. Protecting kids is an important, essential role for all of us. As a parent of two children, I certainly take that role very seriously. But I think, as Dr. Myers very eloquently pointed out, science is complicated, and it's evolving, and it's technical. So what we have in this legislation is a Herculean task. And so any approaches that can be made to make that task more practical and pragmatic, I think, should be pursued. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. So one of the things you were suggesting is that in defining what's functionally equivalent, make sure that quality and applicability is part of it. I mean, that sort of strikes me as what you mean by functional equivalent, but you're saying make sure that's clear.
Well, yes, sir. What I'm suggesting is if you're going to go through a risk assessment for the priority chemical, we would recommend that you do the same robust risk assessment for the substituted chemical to make sure that you're not replacing one problem with another.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a question. I'm trying to clarify in Section 3 of the bill on lines subdivision 1, essentially. And you've got, this is the identification of priority chemicals subject to regulation. You list a number of conditions. The department may designate a chemical as a priority chemical, defines and lists these things. Are those, do all of them have to be found, or any one of them would be a criteria designate sure. as a priority chemical? In other words, does a chemical have to be discovered and meet all these conditions, or any one of them?
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, I assume that's for me. I think they're disjunctive. I mean, it's or.
So if it meets any of these, then it would be considered to be designated as a high priority chemical?
I think.
I see nodding the heads, Mr. Chairman. Yep. My question, yep. I guess, that's the way I read it. I just want to clarify that, because I was trying to think if there is any chemical that is excluded by this list. You say that the chemical has been found through sampling to be present in dust, air, water, anywhere else in the home environment. That pretty much covers everything, doesn't it? Is there anything that wouldn't be potentially designated as a high priority chemical?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hunt, I believe I can answer that. I know you described it as a Herculean task, but it's not as complicated as it might initially seem. Some states, including Maine and Washington, have already generated priority chemical lists. And the first list of chemicals of high concern is about 1,500 chemicals. Those that are found in children's products that are also found in the human exposure realm, they've been found in the human body, is a list of between 50 and 80 chemicals. So we're not talking about thousands of chemicals here.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might also, I think what Senator Hahn is talking about on in section 3, and that list of things that would cause the department to designate a chemical of high concern as a priority chemical. If you go back to chemical of high concern on the first page and see how that's defined, it would not be an innocuous I don't know if there is such a thing as an innocuous chemical, but it would not be something that didn't do one of these things, such as genetic damage, reproductive harm, disruption of. So it does tie back to that.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the only thing I was getting at is that if it's on that list, it would then seem to me to be that the department can designate any chemical on that list as high priority. That was my point, since when you list these other conditions, they don't seem to rule anything out. That was my point. So is that section even necessary? Just say the department and designated chemical
pipe
priority chemical. Period.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, and that and Senator Hand, that may be possible, but it does tie back to, I don't know. I have to think that through and talk it through. But as long as you know, it has to be shown to be harmful. It's known. The language in the definition of chemical of high concern says it has to be known to harm the normal development of a fetus, et cetera, et cetera.
Are there any further questions, especially for Ms. Roberts, since she's from out of town? If not, I think because of the time, we had better adjourn for today, and from now on, the rest of this testimony on this bill will be just before the Health Committee when we meet. We may have time to deal with these bills on Wednesday, so we will check with the two authors, see if you're available then.
Mr. Chair, could I also ask that staff retain these materials in our committee's files so we'll have that? We don't have to read them.
We'll make sure that happens. Thank you very much, Senator and members of the committee, for staying around so long.
Just a recommendation.
Thank you.
Certainly. Because this wasn't there.